Hey friends, just a quick content warning before this episode. I talk about several different books in this episode, and those books may contain some subjects and themes that are potentially triggering. I don't go into detail about most of them, or any of them really, except the cult part, but I just wanted to give you a heads up that there's some mention of eating disorders, religious trauma, parental neglect, the Holocaust, and some OCD triggers. So if you are not up in a place to hear mentions of those, this might not be the episode for you. I don't actually go into detail about most of these, so if you think you're in a place to listen, please feel free. But if not, no one's going to be upset with you. We'll catch you next time. Hi, welcome to Info Dumpies. My name's Brianne. I'm autistic, I have ADHD, my pronouns are she, her, and do we decimal system? We don't.
Hi, I'm Violet, my pronouns are she, her, I have ADHD, and the only book I don't like is the one from the movie Pagemaster called Fantasy, where she's got the weird glass slippers, but you can see her weirdly, highly rendered feet in
the
through
the only book you don't like?
The only book I really don't like, yeah. Most books I'll tolerate, but that's a book I won't tolerate.
Mein Kampf?
Okay, well, that's another one.
That's just off the top of my head.
That's two. That makes two.
Okay.
So.
Okay, that book is bad.
Yeah.
But like, I don't think it's the only one.
You got me there. There's a lot of books I don't like, but especially
that one with the freaky feet.
That played by Whoopi Goldberg. Some foot fetishist drew that. You can't tell me otherwise.
Someone who wanted to see Whoopi's feet.
Yeah.
I watched Star Trek The Next Generation.
This is a cartoon character who is a living book with a semi-realistic
with her dogs out.
Yeah, just like, did you have to render every toe?
Every toe.
And they're wearing translucent glass slippers. Like, just, you're nasty. Admit it. Anyway, that's what we're talking about, right? Is nasty books?
No, we're not. We're okay. Trying what is not a new format for Info Dumpies in general, but possibly a new format for episodes that are Brianne episodes. And I'm tentatively calling it Brianne's Book Report.
Oh, wait, no. That's a different thing.
Yeah, no. Well, no, that was Haunted Dog
Watch. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Right. Yeah, you got me.
I need to come up with my own stinger for that. But yeah, we're doing Brianne's Book Report. So I read a lot, either physical books or audiobooks or digital books. I am reading on my phone. I read a lot. And I decided that it would kind of be fun for me to dump about some of the books I've read this year that have made me feel particularly one way or another. It's not all good. Some of them made me very angry, but these are ones that I've finished.
Some of them have feet.
Oh. I don't think so.
All right, Valid.
I'm trying to recall. I mean, there are feet in some of them, but it's not about feet.
That's good. I'm glad that that's the case.
Sorry to anyone who was hoping this would be about feet. So yeah, we're going to go through some books that I've read this year. These are off the top of my dome, just ones that I'm like, which books made me feel something strongly one way or another. So it does not mean I endorse the entire book. Does not mean I endorse all of its contents or the person who wrote it.
That's fair.
It just means that I read it this year. It made me feel something. And maybe on some of the good ones, you, the listener, may want to give them a read yourself. I don't know.
Nice. Hell yeah. I'm
so
down.
We're starting with one that is not for the faint of heart. Is one that some of these, okay, so these are not all new books. If you're like, Brianne, that book came out ages ago. Bitch, I don't care. I'm reading the book. This is not current events.
Right.
So this book is I'm Glad My Mom Died by Jeanette McCurdy.
I bet that's a big one for you.
Yeah. So are you familiar with this book?
I know you've told me a little bit about it, and obviously I don't want to spoil anything, but I know it's about a person who has a really difficult relationship with their mom and kind of the stories.
Very specifically, Jeanette McCurdy from iCarly, from iCarly fame. I was a little too old when iCarly came out. I was not the target audience at that time. I was a little older, so I have no connection to her as Sam. It's Sam. Sam from iCarly.
You would know better than I would because I did not watch iCarly.
I didn't either. I'm recalling when she mentions her character in the book.
Got it.
So, not for the faint of heart. This book was, I would not recommend it to people who are in a delicate place in regards to religious trauma and or eating disorders, because it talks about those. I'm not going to dwell on those in my discussion of the book, but it was actually recommended to me by my therapist. Since I had gone no contact with my mom just a few months prior to reading it, my therapist had read it and said, hey, a lot of what she had to go through reminds me of everything you have had to go through, so you might feel less alone reading this book. And like most things, he was spot on, because I did feel a lot less alone seeing someone else go through this.
That's really good. It's rare for a book to be able to evoke that sort of feeling, so I'm glad that that was able to do that for you.
Yeah, and it being a memoir and not being a fictionalized story of this tumultuous relationship, but being someone who actually went through it herself, I think that was nice too.
Yeah, because so, I feel like it's one thing to kind of feel represented or to feel seen in a book, and it's another thing to feel like you've been accompanied, like you have someone else who's kind of been on the same journey, right?
Yeah, and that's like, it is, so it is hard to do that when I know everyone in my real life is not in that same situation, and I can't just go seek out people to go, hey, did you talk to your mom? Are you okay? Like, I can't just go to a new friend and go, so you and your mom, do you talk?
No.
Okay.
So tell me about your mother.
Yeah. Was your mom a bitch too? Oh, okay. Interesting. So Jeanette also has OCD. I have OCD. I don't talk about it a lot here, but I have OCD. And having OCD and growing up in a religious household is like a horrible combo, and so much of how she felt about stuff, because I used to write mine off as a kid as like, I've done something that made God mad, or if I don't do this, it'll make God mad. And that's a lot of what she goes through. But yeah, if you're someone with a shitty relationship with your mom, I would say this book is worth it, but definitely only if you're in a place where triggering some of those memories will not have you incapacitated.
And yeah,
it took me a while to get through this book because so much of it was like, oof, okay, oh.
I know that feeling. I've had a few, I have trouble reading just because of my ADHD. I have really trouble with, like, focusing on a physical book, but audiobooks for me have been really good. And I recently listened to a couple books that I kind of had a similar experience with, but they weren't mom related. My mom's awesome. I'm very lucky in that regard. I love you, Mama, if you're listening.
Yeah, Violet has like parents that care about her and love her unconditionally, which James and I are always like, whoa, I thought that was fake, but no.
I'm very fortunate. I got a great mama and a great dad, and I love them very much. Shout out to Mike and Sandy. Hell yeah.
Hell yeah, Mike and Sandy. Thanks for making my girlfriend.
They did great.
They did a great job.
Yeah.
So the next book is actually one that I reread, but I had not read this since embarking on today's lucky winner. And it definitely hit different now that I have a really consistent creative practice and I'm really consistently writing and creating things. That's very often hard to find a rhythm for that when you're ADHD. It feels like either hyper-focus or nothing, and I found a really good balance.
Yeah.
And I reread this book, and when you hear who it's by, you'll know the obvious reason that I reread it. It's Catching the Big Fish by David Lynch.
Wow. It's David Lynch.
And his passing this year made me very sad because, hey, I don't want to diagnose anyone, but if you're autistic and like David Lynch, you understand that you like the man because he was also autistic as hell. Like, I don't want to diagnose anyone, but he ate the same thing every single day because he said it helped him have fewer choices to make and left more room for his creativity. He went to the Bob's Big Boy to go get a coffee and a milkshake and smoke a cigarette at the same time, the same day, every week. Yeah, so I had read this a while ago. I had forgotten a lot, and it all hit me much differently as someone with a regular creative practice who, when you have an idea that you actually write and are actively, like, creating and working on and finish, there is this fear that it's like, what if this was my only one good idea? What if this is all I had in me? And Catching the Big Fish, the premise is that if you have one good idea, that'll help you catch others. So a lot of the book is about transcendental meditation, and that's where he does his metaphorical fishing for ideas. Even if you aren't into transcendental meditation, I think it's good for people who, A, like David Lynch, and B, are creatives. You don't even have to be a David Lynch fan. It will seem a little odd if you are not a David Lynch fan, the way he writes about some things. And then occasionally, there'll be a really small snippet where he's like, I was given a digital camera in 2008. I thought digital was going to be soulless, but the beauty of digital, and he just goes on about digital cameras for a little bit. If you're familiar with him, you will read the whole thing in his voice. I almost guarantee it, because I sure as shit did. But yeah, it's about the creative process, as he puts it, living the art life.
I love that.
Because to him, art in any art form, for those of you unfamiliar, he was a filmmaker, and he made some of the weirdest shit there was, and I ate that shit up. He also did the TV show Twin Peaks, which, if you want a bunch of autistic-coded characters doing weird stuff, there you go. And everyone's very pretty.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone's extremely pretty in Twin Peaks.
Absolutely, yeah. It's got good vibes.
Excellent. It's very much a show that feels like fall to me.
Yeah, it feels like you're tripping in fall a little bit.
Yes. So in this book, he talks about his own life experiences. And if you're familiar with his work, he talks about specific things that he did growing up. That you're like, oh, that was in Blue Velvet. Oh, that was in Mulholland Drive. Oh, that was in this. And you can kind of connect them to his work. But he also talks about process a lot. And I love how much he doesn't have a set process. Something I have discovered with other autistic people when I talk about, because I have some clients who found me through podcasting and they're like, hey, how do you get the fiction from brain and out and organized? We talk about the artistic process, and autistic people, especially ADHD people, kind of like how ADHDers tend to buy a bunch of equipment for a new hobby and then not actually pull the trigger on doing the thing. I feel like ADHD people tend to collect a bunch of information as well about ways, like, here's how to do it, here's how to do it. But the problem is, with art, there is no formula. There is no magic order of doing things. And honestly, if you follow a formula all of the time, you're probably not going to make something really interesting. And there's a real tendency for us to want to know the right way to do something. And I think if you're an ADHD creative, this book might help you snap out of the idea that you have to keep learning the theory of writing and everything. I could go on a whole tangent about that because, hey, all of human life is storytelling. Sure, there are things that make for good storytelling and bad storytelling, but the way we communicate everything to each other is through story. So you inherently have a storyteller in you. It's just organizing that for your fiction. So one of the things that annoyed me about another book, which is On Writing by Stephen King, is that Stephen King is like, no, you can't learn to write. I'm just a special boy. You either have it or you don't. Right. And I'm like, fuck off, you weird asshole who randomly tweeted about how he doesn't think the Epstein files are weird when it's like, bro, nobody actually asked you. That looks sus.
Like, hey, I'm just putting it out there. I don't think the Epstein files are...
Just putting it out there. I think they're fake.
I think it's fake.
And it's like, Steven, nobody asked you,
if anyone's name
bro.
Should appear on there, it's basically not valid.
Yeah.
If there's a Blevin King on there, I don't know who that is. Not related to me.
It's different, Steven. Mine's spelled with a V now. Surprised you.
Yeah.
But anyway, catching the big fish also... if you don't have the spoons to read the book, someone also uploaded all of David Lynch's masterclass onto YouTube.
Oh.
I think it's still up there. And it is essentially a breakdown of this book.
Nice.
But with more visuals, more stuff to keep you interested. It's just lovely hearing it from him.
Absolutely,
he has a way of talking about things. But yes, if you're a creative, highly recommend it, especially if you love David Lynch. It kind of felt like a warm hug from my my surrogate fiction, not even fictional, my surrogate guy who didn't know he served as a grandpa to me, but here we are.
Yeah, definitely.
So the next book is one that made me angry.
And it didn't have feet?
Okay, well, the people in the book, I'm assuming, had feet. She didn't go into that detail. Maybe I shouldn't assume.
That's fair.
I just kind of assume feet unless told otherwise.
Gotcha. No, that's totally valid. I meant like physically, did the book have feet on it?
Oh, on it?
Yeah, because the book in Pagemaster that I hate.
Oh, no, this book didn't have feet on it.
Oh, okay, got it. Cool. Just checking, got it. So I don't. In that case, I don't understand why you wouldn't like it.
Well, this book was, and you'd think I would like it, given what a slut for vampires I am. It was Memnock the Devil by Anne Rice.
Okay.
So this is the fifth in the Vampire Chronicles series from Anne Rice.
Got it.
Now, if we rewind a little bit to the fourth book in the series, Tale of the Body Thief, I had started to become disillusioned with where Anne was going with her tales of Lestat. Some of you may know the series because you read it yourself. I had read the first three way too young as a tween, because Queen of the Damned came out when puberty was hitting for me, and that did something fundamentally to my little baby bisexual brain. And I was like, oh, I need to read these books.
Yeah, that activated the bisexuality innate in you.
Oh, that was active before. Yeah. No, I think Buffy the Vampire Slayer did that. But yeah, Memnock the Devil. So I was getting a little annoyed by the fourth book, and by the fifth book, I just got angry. Because have you ever started a story and you said, ooh, they're going to do this, and they don't do that, but the thing that you assumed they were going to do is much more interesting than the direction the story went?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. I'm done reading this series after this.
Oh, wow.
I'm done. So I finished it. I'm just done. It's not good.
Wow.
The book starts you off, started me off at least, thinking that Lestat was going to change places with the devil.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that would be really cool. Be badass.
Like the vibe I got was that Satan was tired of being Satan and wanted to go party on Earth, and he was going to let Lestat be Satan. And Lestat's, like, I don't know how much of this series you have either consumed via movies or TV or whatever.
Very little.
But bratty French bisexual vampire who at one point decides he's going to out all vampires and become a rock star, where he just goes, no, I am straight up a vampire. Love him. He's such a little cunt. So I thought, of course my boy would be like, I'd love to be Satan. That sounds delicious. Yes, let me be Satan. He is one of those vampires who tries to only feed on criminals. Doesn't always. But yeah, so it took I'm not going to spoil everything, but it took a left turn into something completely different and far less interesting than where I assumed it was going.
I think I remember you telling me a little bit about this or complaining to me about this.
I was livid. Because I was like, Anne Rice, I should not have come up with a more interesting story than what you've presented to me here. The last book, he gets his body swapped with a human.
Mm-hmm.
So the last book I was like, am I really reading this? Lestat's complaining about how much he hates shitting.
I mean, fair. Honestly, I'm not a fan.
Yeah, yeah. So he hates shitting and he gets like the flu or something and is like, kill me and my suffering.
Yeah.
So the last book was not good, but this one, so Lestat goes to heaven. He pops up to heaven. He takes a cheeky pop up to heaven like you do, huh? And just sees heaven. He becomes obsessed with a young woman who is a televangelist and lives in an abandoned abbey in, I believe it is New Orleans. I forget. He becomes obsessed with her. She reciprocates kind of this obsession, fully knowing that Lestat murdered her dad.
Huh?
You killed my dad, no. But my dad wasn't a good man, and you can't help what you are. And, like, I don't
give a shit.
My name
is Tracy Televangelist. You killed my father. Prepare to fuck. Like,
yeah, yeah. Like, it's just so weird. What? And, like, he has a tendency to get obsessed with individual humans. This girl is like, nothing bad will come of this, I'm sure. So he's usually like delightful to me. He's usually bratty. One of my favorite things is I could tell Anne Rice loves interior decorating because this bitch will always be like, I looked at the damask curtains, this velvet damask curtains all over the walls, the chenille throws across the velour couch, and he's always talking about fabrics and shit and how lush things are. This to me lost all of my beautiful bisexual boy time. So yeah, in the last book, he turns a human that he cares about very deeply without this human's consent. Uh-huh. Yeah. So I think the diversion from the somewhat honorable bad boy that I loved in the first three books is ultimately what has driven me away. Mm-hmm. And I will not be reading any more of this series. It made me incredibly angry. It's one of those books that I wish I hadn't finished.
You know, I haven't had that specific experience more than one time. And the only time I've ever had that was with Ready Player One. Because I was like, don't tell me anything. I don't want to read any reviews. I want to see if this is good. People are talking about it. I'm curious. I listened to it on audiobook and I got two chapters in and I was like, this is garbage. And then I was like, I don't know what compelled me to keep listening, but I did. And I finished it. And by the time I got to the end, I was like, I think I was just hoping it would redeem itself somehow. And it never did.
I have such trouble just deciding I don't want to finish this book. I will cognitively know that I don't want to finish this book, but I think the autism's like, you started it, you have to finish it. Or it might be the OCD. I don't know. It's very rare. Less rare if it's an audiobook. If it's an audiobook, I'm more likely to be like, all right, return it early. But yeah, so this one, did not enjoy. So the next one, I put the two that I didn't like in the middle, so we could end on a good note.
Cool.
So the next one I'm going to complain about is Aware by Dr. Dan Siegel. So I read a lot of nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Very often the nonfiction I'm reading is also for work. For my coaching, I'm trying to read anything I can about autism that seems valuable, anything about ADHD, anything I can about things like nervous system regulation, meditation, routines, habits, all of these kinds of things that could potentially give me tools to help my clients, because part of why they're coming to me is very likely that they're burnt out, and if I can help them sift through the stuff that's useful or not, that's part of my job. So I read a lot of books about human brains and taking care of yourself and routine and human behavior. So Aware by Dan Siegel is a book that on the surface looks like it is about a certain type of meditation technique, a meditation technique called the Wheel of Awareness. Now, I think the meditation technique is cool and valuable. Okay. The things he claims this meditation technique can and should do, and what every human needs to be a well-rounded human, or deeply ableist.
Ooh. That's not good. Yeah. It's really frustrating when someone's like, hey, here's some good advice, and you should do this good advice because of these abhorrent reasons. Like, come
on. And, like, I get that these people have to sell you on the thing that they're telling you is helpful.
Right.
I get that, but a lot of it was deeply ableist. So the thing that made me interested in the Wheel of Awareness is that so much Western meditation is focused on your attention inward on yourself completely. And this part of it is meditating on your connection to those around you, which is very often missing from Western mindfulness meditation practices, because most Western mindfulness meditation has taken from Buddhism, really, stripped it of all religious connotation and made it highly individualistic.
That's a good point.
Yeah, so like one of the meditations I like to do is called Tonglen meditation, and that is like inner kindness to others sort of meditation practice, where you breathe in all of the bad stuff and breathe out like love and kindness for others. Because the world is on fire right now, it's very easy for me to hate every single person I meet.
I relate to that very much. I felt like there was a good 6 months or so last year where I was like, I'm a nihilist. Like, I will freely admit I'm a nihilist. I hate everyone. Everyone sucks. So
yeah. So I thought this was interesting because there's also the Wheel of Awareness includes focusing on all of the senses, including interoception. It looks at your senses of what's around you. It looks at your sense of self and your sense of connection to those in your community. Well, he claims it helps with chronic pain, and that he gives a testimonial of someone who helped their chronic pain and implies that pain is in the mind. And one thing I will point out, Dr. Dan Siegel has an MD, a medical doctor.
Boy. You know, honestly, it's gotten to the point now where if I see a testimonial, I'm instantly suspicious.
And that's one of the things with books about, that's one of the things I hate about so many of these books about different modalities of caring for yourself and stuff, is that they're rife with testimonials because they feel like they have to prove to you that it worked for somebody. Yeah. Which to me, I also, when I see a testimonial, that's one of my red flags for if a product is snake oil.
Yep, absolutely.
Is if it's a lot of testimonials. Snake.
Yeah, because I feel like there's a fine line between a testimonial and a review, and the difference is objective and subjective, right? A review is supposed to be, you know, you're not biased in any way. You're just saying, here's how I feel about this thing. A testimonial is inherently biased because it is a group of people leaving testimonials that are, or maybe not objective versus subjective. Maybe that's not the right term.
It's not an objective versus subjective thing. But with the testimonials, they're also, names have been changed and he is telling you about these people. And to me, that's like, okay, they may or may not be real. How am I going to know?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So one, he claims it helps with health issues. That if you integrate your mind, so many of your health issues will go away. So I already can tell, because my guy is an MD, that he is one of those doctors who's like, have you considered losing weight? Have you considered meditation? Yeah. Have you considered yoga? Have you considered that everything that's wrong with you is your fault, actually?
Probably
that's
like
the vibe.
Almost like a Scientologist, where everything that happens to you is somehow your fault.
You pull it in, as they say.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Some of that nonsense.
So I was really stuck because the actual meditation practice and describing it was helpful, but he also claims, so this is something, I am a low empathy autistic person. It is so controversial to talk to. I lose at least 20 followers every time I post about being low empathy. People conflate empathy with giving a shit about other people, when in fact, empathy is just your ability to feel and understand another person's feelings.
Sure.
So if Violet's sad, I hate that she's sad, but I don't suddenly start feeling my own sadness. Does it mean I don't give a shit about Violet? Absolutely not. I love her. And I have the experience of being sad in the past, and I say, oh, that suck. Don't want girlfriend to feel feeling that suck. Let me do something to help her.
Yeah.
So he claims that empathy is necessary for humans to show compassion.
No.
And if we're defining things, compassion is the ability to see suffering in another person to find a way to reduce that suffering.
Dogs do that. Like, I don't understand how that could be a human-only trait.
Well, like, not just that it's human-only, but so many people say, no, empathy is what makes us human, and it absolutely is not.
To me,
having to feel what someone else is feeling or understand that feeling in order to show them compassion is just a fucking skill issue.
It's honestly kind of strange because, like, I'm holistic. So oftentimes if I'm around like a friend that I care about a lot and they're crying, it'll be very easy for me to start crying too and to feel a lot of the same, like almost mirroring their feelings. But I completely recognize I don't need that to happen for me to be compassionate to that person.
Right, right. I don't need to feel that myself.
Right. It's almost silly, it sounds to me.
Yeah, so he claims that part of what this does is cultivate empathy. So if you're a low empathy autistic person, you're not broken. You're not Jeffrey Dahmer. You probably use something called cognitive empathy, which is actually going through a cognitive process to try to put yourself in the other person's shoes to understand what they're feeling. And even when I do that, because that's something I've had to work on in order to try to understand how to show other people compassion in a way that they need, it still doesn't evoke that feeling in me. I basically use the Stanislavski method of acting to interact with other humans. And that involves going back to a time in your life when you felt similarly to a character, as close as you can think of, and pulling up those emotions and how you felt. I never actually feel that way myself. I just recall, oh, that was that feeling. And the fact that he's an MD, I am begging people to, when someone has doctor in front of their name, does not mean they're an expert in everything they're talking about. I say that as the child of two doctors who didn't know what the fuck they're talking about most things. So.
That's very valid. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's a phrase that comes to mind, and I don't know, I don't remember if I made it up or if I heard it somewhere, but even a bad mechanic can have good, high quality tools, you know? So with this meditation practice, I don't think he invented it, right? I think he's just...
It's probably one of those things that he stole from some other Eastern practice that I don't know the name of and rebranded and slightly changed.
Yeah.
But yeah, I hated this book. I appreciated a new meditation practice method, but I would personally rather stick to Tonglen meditation and not to filter my compassionate meditation exercise through this Western lens of a guy who thinks that I need to fix my own health with meditation. It made me so fucking angry. Okay, so the next book. Now we're back to books that I enjoyed.
Yay!
The next book is called Letters to My Weird Sisters by Joanne Lindberg.
I already like it.
So Lindberg writes letters to women in the past in whom she sees a kindred sisterhood. She's an autistic woman in her 50s. Each of these women reminds her of her experience as an autistic woman, and she uses their stories to talk about feminism through an autistic lens.
Oh, that sounds cool.
Yeah. So one of the things I really like is that she fully acknowledges her own privileges, and she makes sure she brings that up at the beginning of things so you understand her perspective and where she is lacking in experience.
I love that.
So she says, I am a white, cishet British woman of... in my 50s, of a certain socioeconomic bracket, et cetera, et cetera. This is my experience. Take what I say with a grain of salt. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. She's just says intersectionality is important. She also acknowledges that the people in the book are largely white and European, the people she's writing to. And she calls into question why those stories were the easiest for her to get access to in the first place. And those that were recorded in the first place.
Yeah. It's not hard to imagine why, unfortunately.
So I don't want to give it all away and about everyone she writes to. But Lindberg herself is Jewish. And she talks about a few Jewish women during World War II. So if you are not in a place to hear about the Holocaust, this book will be a little rough.
Gotcha.
She goes into some detail. But autistic people and disabled people were some of the first... to be murdered in the Holocaust, so it comes up. It is rough in the sense that she's a really evocative writer, so when she does talk about these women, you start to care for each of them to a certain degree by the end of her respective letters. So I will say, the first woman she writes to is Virginia Woolf, who we talked about in the bisexuality episode.
Heck yeah.
And I love that she doesn't put her up on a pedestal. She says, you know, like, actually, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out, Virginia, that you were anti-Semitic, ableist, and a snob. And she's not going to glorify the dead.
Yeah.
And she brings up some very specific instances where Virginia said some fucking out-of-pocket shit about disabled people and poor people and stuff. But I highly recommend if you're an autistic woman. There is a lot that was relatable. Lindbergh also has OCD. So I was like, oh, cool. You got that in the autistic trauma package, too. Excellent.
Oh, nice.
So there's a whole thing that made me laugh because adopting Moogie really made my OCD go into overdrive. It's just one of those things. There's a new variable and I don't feel like I have control over a lot of things. And Lindbergh also talks about my OCD showed up when I had my first child. And here are all the things I convinced myself would happen if I stopped caring for them as thoroughly as I needed to, and I didn't follow everything to the letter. So it's really interesting hearing about, like, hey, caring for another life made my OCD worse. So if you have OCD, also pretty relatable.
Yeah, that's interesting. It makes a lot of sense to me, just from an outside perspective, someone who does not have OCD, to, like, you've added, like you said, you've added a new variable, and, like, not a small variable. This is another life you're caring for.
Yeah, and so many things could go wrong.
All of the things that you had a very specific, I don't know if this is the right term, ritual for, like, they're kind of thrown off. Everything's got to change.
It's not just that. It's that there's so many things that can go wrong taking care of any living creature.
I see.
And when things, my OCD will flare when things feel out of control. So it definitely feels out of control when you're trying to adjust to having this new life in your house. And she talks about how hers hit when she was pregnant and her office was upstairs and there was just a tiny window, and her OCD convinced her that, well, hey, if there's a fire, you're really pregnant and you're going to have to be able to get out that window. And what if, you know, this happens and these rags fall into your trash can? And she talks about realizing she needed to do something about whatever was going on with her mental health, because she didn't know she had OCD when she was pregnant, when she found herself having crawled through that window in her office and was standing on the roof to the lower part of the house while, like, I think she said, like, 6 months pregnant.
Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah, because she just needed to see if she could get out, and that's what her OCD was telling her. So, yeah, highly recommend. So the
next... Yeah, it sounds really interesting. Oh, sorry, I was just going to say, even if you're not autistic, that sounds interesting just to see that perspective.
Yeah, it definitely... It's another one of those books where if you're an autistic woman who does not have other autistic women in your life, and you don't have people who you can talk about that feeling of feeling like you're trying to connect with other people through, like, the way I put it is, like, 6 inches of aquarium glass, it's really good at making you feel understood in that way.
What's your last book?
This is not my last book. We're down to my two favorite books that I think I've read. I mean, two favorite books I've read this year. Next, we have Cultish by Amanda Montell. So Cultish is a book by Amanda Montell, who is a linguist whose father escaped a cult at the age of 17.
Wow.
And this book is all about the language of cults, or as she calls cult language, Cultish. Like English.
Oh, interesting. I was going to ask about the title, actually. Like, how did that title come about? That makes total sense.
Montell talks about how language is integral to exerting control in a cult. And she points out the patterns and trends in how language is used in these capacities. And she sections the book out. She talks about what you think of as traditional cults. She talks about social media cults, which I'll get into in a sec. Oh. Wild. Talks about fitness classes being a cult, like CrossFit and Bar Method.
Yeah.
And
oh, wow.
And she says all of these things exist on a cult-ish spectrum.
Yeah.
Like, there's a spectrum.
That's interesting.
So she talks about this spectrum of cultiness to things, but how language is used similarly. And the thing that got me was she initially talks about the 3HO cult, which is the one we talked about in my first episode of Infodumpies.
Oh, yeah.
I did, who make the yogi tea. So she's like, some of the things that they did in 3HO are some of the same things, the same language things, at least, that get people feeling invested in community in Peloton.
That's so interesting. This is actually, of all the ones you've mentioned so far, this is the one I think I most am already, like, I kind of want to see if I can get an audiobook for this because it's
really
interesting.
I actually listened to this as an audiobook on Libby, so our library has it.
Heck yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because the idea that, like, my default, right, assumption, like, you see a group of people that are doing CrossFit or whatever, I don't think of that as a cult inherently. I think of that as, like, oh, it's a social group, but there's so much expectation in that social group and so much, like, I kind of take for granted with a lot of these things that I sort of just think of as social groups that are, like,
and
no, it makes
are.
Sense that there would be cult-related things. It can be both, yeah. Sure, yeah.
Yeah, but it can be both.
I thought of them as, like, just a social group, nothing more.
And she also pushes back against the word cult and brought about a perspective on what gets labeled as a cult and what doesn't that was new to me and I found really interesting. So me, who has been hyperfixated on cults since I was a little kid, she changed my view on calling all of these, which they get called new religious movements. She has made me pull back a little bit at, well, they meet a lot of cult criteria, so that's a cult.
Interesting.
So the example she gives, which I was not aware this happened. Well, I was aware it happened, but I hadn't thought about this perspective that in Waco, when the DEA raided the David Koresh's compound in Waco, the media manufactured consent for this raid and for the deaths of civilians by calling it a cult because suddenly those people chose to be there. Those people chose to be involved with this crazy thing. Those aren't people anymore. It's used to dehumanize them. They are just crazy cult members and not human beings anymore.
Yeah. Oh my God. And just my first thought on that as a person who plays a lot of video games is how often in video games are cultists just kind of a random villain, someone they're like, oh, it's assumed that they're evil if they're a cultist, and also it's assumed that you're gonna have to kill them to, you know, and that they're choosing to do all of this evil stuff. And wow,
yeah, and
there's so,
like,
much stigma there.
And like David Koresh definitely was abusing these people, but they themselves were not a risk. So she talks about how labeling something as a cult is very serious, because people, it manufactures consent to see the people involved as less human. So I was like, wow, I had not thought of that before. That is such a valid and interesting take. So yeah, she also talks about things like MLMs and how they use language. There's a whole chapter where she's like, hey girl, and does it like you get those DMs from girls you went to high school with.
Let me tell you about these leggings that I've been just crazy about lately.
Talks about LuLaRoe. About Amway, which I did not realize how balls deep Amway was in American politics.
Oh, jeez. I didn't know either. I don't know now.
Yeah. So she talks about Peloton. She talks about bar method. She talks about core power yoga. She talks about Instagram and YouTube cults, where I learned about someone named Teal Swan, who is tangentially responsible for suicides via YouTube and using SEO for evil.
Oh, that's dark. That sucks.
Yeah. You know,
another thought that I had, that the idea of not stigmatizing and like assigning these like non-human traits to these people that have been sucked in by a cult reminds me a lot of the way that people treat people who fall for scams. When I was getting trained to do IT stuff, there was a really big emphasis when you are working in IT to, you know, because there's phishing attempts and people are constantly out there saying, oh, I'm this, you know, prince from South Africa or whatever. I'll give you $1 million if you send me 10,000 or something. Right. People, it seems ridiculous in hindsight, outside of the moment, to fall for those scams. But realistically, the people that are falling for these scams are people that are in a vulnerable position.
Yes.
They're very lonely. They're very isolated. They don't have someone to quote, for lack of a better term, sanity check this request against. That is why they're falling for it. It's not a personal failing. this is a vulnerable person. And I feel like it's a similar situation for people that get sucked into a cult.
Very often, yes. But I think not enough people understand that they themselves are vulnerable to cults. They think they are not someone who could fall into that.
Everyone thinks that, yeah.
So one of the things I thought was cool was her talking about how Jim Jones and Donald Trump use a lot of the same language techniques to foster their audience.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Yeah. She also talks in the vein of how we dehumanize people who are in cults. How often have you heard someone nonchalantly throw around the phrase, drink the Kool-Aid?
Oh my God, all the time. Constantly.
People died.
People use that interchange. Yeah, people use that interchangeably.
Babies died.
Yeah.
And people...
It's not right.
But people will make fun of it. Like, if we're talking about the Jonestown Massacre, it's like 900 people who died.
Yeah.
So she talks about how we manufacture consent for people who get sucked into cults to meet bad ends by the way we talk about them, and how we use language around cults that treats them as non-human, which I thought was, it's just a take I've never heard before, and I've read a lot of shit about cults.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm intrigued. I think I'm gonna have to listen to this one for sure.
Yeah, really good. So yeah, I think this book is great for the layperson who doesn't really know anything about linguistics or cults. I think it leaves you with some sort of mental tools for recognizing when some people are using language to try to control you. And she also talks about like her own fitness class she goes into. She's like, I spend money to go to this class. I make friends in this class. I feel like I'm part of an exclusive group, but no one's going to make me give them all of my money or work in servitude or kill me at this class. So sure, there might be some cult-ish properties to Peloton, but it's not the end of the world, and people seek this community this hard for a reason and overlook these red flags so much for a reason. But anyway, I thought it was amazing. So, great book.
Heck yeah.
So the
what was it called one more time?
Cult-ish. C-U-L-T-I-S-H by Amanda Montell. So the final one, if you're one of my clients listening, I've probably recommended this book to you because it was so good, but it's called Autistic Thinking: How Autistic People Think, Learn, and Remember by Dr. Alondra Rogers. I read so much about autism that I reach with most things I start reading what I have referred to as the research Ouroboros, where I start reading it and say, I already know that, I already know that, duh, I already know that, I already know that. Like, I've reached the other end of it. Not with this book at all. This, to me, was the most useful, easily accessible book about autism I've read all year. She, too, acknowledges her own privilege, letting the reader know that while she makes an earnest effort to be intersectional, the reality is that she's writing these things from a place of privilege. So she will fall short, just given her lived experience, but she's doing her best. She also acknowledges the intersection of ADHD and autism. And I usually have to take books about just autism with a grain of salt because they don't generally usually account for the possibility of also having ADHD.
Right.
She's quite nuanced, which is unfortunately difficult in the autism community to find nuanced takes on things. They want to show you one part of the spectrum looks like, and they don't talk about the other ones a lot of the time. So she talks about experiences across the spectrum, how we may differ, what some of our most common experiences are, how those different traits may interact with other marginalizations, how those different traits may be the product of being raised with certain marginalizations. She acknowledges that with autism, a lot of the time, there is not research about how to live our best lives. So some of the things she fully says, we don't have research about this yet. But when there is research, she's incredibly well-sourced. If she's referencing a study or a paper, it is clearly denoted in the footnotes.
That's awesome.
So I literally got to go, oh, okay, let me go look up this exact fucking paper. And it's right here on this page. So my ADHD isn't going to go, oh, look that up in the back later. It's right there.
Gotcha.
Which is my favorite. Because if it's in the bibliography for like sources, I'm probably going to forget I wanted to go look that up later.
Gotcha. And there was definitely a section on Tylenol and circumcision, right?
Not yet. Maybe the updated version.
Gotcha.
So the thing I also really enjoyed is that it's written both for autistic people and those who interact and work with autistic people. Each chapter ends with actionable takeaways, actual things you can do if you yourself are the autistic person or someone who just cares about an autistic person in some capacity.
I do that.
You do that. So I have recommended this to clients before to say, hello, have your spouse read this.
Oh, I'll have to check that one out too.
So there's also a section on Gestalt language processing and Gestalt processing that I thought was amazing. So I don't know how much you know about Gestalt processing.
I have talked to you about it before at one point, but I forget. In this moment, I'm drawing a blank.
Autistic kids tend to acquire language a little differently than non-autistic kids. Non-autistic kids will pick up individual words and individual meaning, and that's how they're learning language. Autistic kids will pick up chunks and phrases that they attribute to the meaning in the moment very often. So they will reuse those in moments that don't seem accurate. So let's say your kid's friend Daniel was coming over to play one time, and you tell your kid, Daniel's coming over to play. You might hear your kid a couple weeks later say, Daniel's coming over to play. Doesn't mean that he thinks Daniel's coming over to play. It probably means he wants that to happen again. And the meaning he ascribes to that is my day I spent with Daniel. So like for me, if it had to do with the phone as a little kid, I'd say, who is it?
Oh, yeah. I remember you telling me about that. That's where we last talked about this, I think, was you saying, anything to do with the phone. Effectively, the phone is a who is it?
Yeah. So apart from mama, my first word was who is it?
That's awesome. You might be saying, I don't actually know what my first word was.
You might be saying, well, Brianne, that's three words. How do you know it's three words other than your ability to read it and understand that they're individual? When you're a baby, you hear all of that. Baby brain didn't know. So there is quite a bit about Gestalt processing with language learning, but not a lot about how those Gestalt processors process things as adults.
Yeah.
Because that the way you process things isn't going to really change that drastic. Yeah, exactly. So there's not a lot about, hey, what does that look like for accommodating for yourself as an autistic adult? And this book actually talks about that, which I thought was amazing.
That's
I have
cool.
searched high and low for content about that.
That's really cool. I love to see a book that hits all the right notes and like covers all the important topics that other people
are
not covering.
And it's a little book. It's small. Really? You could read it in, I think it took me like an hour and a half.
Oh, wow.
And I was taking some notes.
Not to put you on the spot, do you remember about how many pages it is?
I don't recall. We have it downstairs. Okay. I can show you.
Doors.
It's doors. Short. Big print. Lots of bullet points and stuff. So the section on autistic memory was really affirming of my own experience too. So there are things I remember so vividly. I can like smell the memory. And then there are some things that I completely forget happened and you would think I wouldn't, but my brain just didn't file that away as important. So talking about autistic memory differences, personally, I think all autistic people should give this book a read. To understand yourself better. And a really common thing clients come to me with is wanting to understand what are reasonable expectations for yourself. What are the limitations of your disability? And what are the things you should really be putting an effort to getting better at? Because especially I'm dealing with mostly late diagnosed people who have been white knuckling their way through things and saying, oh, yeah, I should be able to do that, and have no sort of frame of reference for how their brain works and what is a reasonable expectation for them. I think this book is like a really good tool in learning what those look like for yourself. Like, she goes so far as to talk about how the different parts of the autistic brain have been shown to deviate from holistic brains on a functional MRI. And she goes part by part. Talking about some autistic amygdalas do this, some autistic amygdalas do that, but here are the trends they noticed in the amygdalas of autistic people. Onto the hypothalamus, onto the brainstem, onto this, and like makes that really digestible. So her presenting you with scientific data on why your brain is literally built different can be really helpful. I think also sometimes because it's your nervous system that's different with autism, it can be one of those disabilities where it's like, yeah, I could totally do that because it's not something you, I don't know, it's not something you're like interfacing in. Like when my endometriosis is bad, I clearly cannot go for a run, right?
Right.
But when it is in my brain and in the rest of my nervous system, it's kind of hard to know what my limitations should be. So anyway, autistic thinking. Good book. So yeah, that's Brianne's book report for now.
Wow. Thank you. Those were all really interesting in either a good or a bad way. It was really cool. Thank you.
So I might do another one of these because I do read a lot, either audiobook or otherwise. And it might be, I thought it might be a fun format because I always want to dump about the books I'm reading.
Yeah, we'll have to workshop the stinger sound that when we do this segment.
Yeah.
Would you say it's a podcast within a podcast? Not really. It's kind of like a...
Is this my Munch Squad?
I mean, maybe. Maybe it's a podcast within a podcast wrapped in an enigma.
Yeah, we'll work on it. I need sort of a verbal stinger, like a wah, 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 or something.
Yeah, yeah. We'll workshop it.
Billy Lee!
Well, hang on. Don't do too much of that. Jerry Seinfeld will come after you.
Hey friends, before I get to thanking our Patreon supporters, I would like to make you aware of a mutual aid opportunity. If you visit the show details, you can find a link to the Chuffed campaign and Instagram page for Funds for Wadi. Wadi is a young Palestinian man living in a tent with his 7 family members, and currently their goal is to get them a new tent. Since aid has also been blocked in Gaza again, one of the goals is to get them enough money to afford the very, very, very expensive food that they can have access to because the aid distribution sites are deadly. Dudley and Wadi had been injured at 1. So if you would like to support this young man and his family and getting them a new tent and getting them food, you can go to our show details to find a link to both his Chuffed campaign and the Funds for Wadi Instagram page, which runs regular raffles to earn money for Wadi and his family. And now I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters like Anarchista, Bethany Glass, Carl Brooks, Chamberlain Foreman, Fintago, Dave Perrell, Gus, Helen Clifford, Janice Weston, K Genius, Kate Michigoose, Laura Kramer, Lilith Rain, Lutzi, Megan E., Natasha Neves, Nanya B., Percy, Rachel Rachelson, Randy Lovings, and Sewing Seraph. Now, you know the usual. The best way you can help us is to tell other people about the show. We don't take advertisements, so unlike some podcasts that are taking advertisements, who are getting ICE ads on Spotify, that is not going to be an issue for us because we don't take ads in the first place. And if you would like to reward us for that, you could tell other people about the show because we don't pay for advertisements either, and we grow entirely by word of mouth. So if you want to help us out, please tell a friend about the show. In addition, you can also subscribe on your podcatcher of choice, and if you interact with episodes and leave ratings and reviews, that really helps us out too. The more action and activity we get on our respective pages on the different podcatchers, the more we get active in the algorithms, and it helps other people find the show more organically. If you're in a place to help us out fiscally, you can go to the show details to find a link to the Mixnomer Patreon page. There we have tiers starting at $1 with varying rewards, and those rewards include everything Mixnomer does now and will be doing in the future to some degree. So if you want to help us out, that money goes towards paying the cast and crew for all of the stuff they do. It goes towards updating people's equipment. It goes to making shows better and letting everyone involved be able to devote more time to making these shows. So if you want to help us out and you appreciate the media that we make, you can go help us out on the Patreon page. Also, if you are someone who was a listener of today's Lucky Winner, and hell, even if you're not, and you know we happen to make an audio drama and you've only listened to Info Dumpies thus far, we have a new show coming out on November 1st called Murphy Bay Magic. Murphy Bay Magic is the spinoff to today's Lucky Winner, but it also acts as a starting point for those of you who maybe wanted to check out our audio drama that we make but don't want to go through about 100 episodes of Today's Lucky Winner, which is a tall order. This offers you a starting point into that universe and is also a place where you can tell friends who maybe you tried getting today's Lucky Winner and it was a little daunting. That's a place for you to have them hop on board. I don't have a name for it yet. The Readaverse, maybe? I don't know. I'll workshop it. Let me know in the Discord server, everybody. But yeah, so how a show does in the first, you know, few episodes of its life can really help the trajectory. And we have a preview of Murphy Bay Magic up on Podcatchers. So if you want to go subscribe to Murphy Bay Magic, listen to the preview, leave a review and rating of the preview if you'd like, really help us get some traction early on. That would help us out a ton. So if you could go do that, that would be incredible. But that's all I've got for you this time, my friends. Until next time, clever sign off.